Chapter 41. That God is the Sovereign Good. From this it is proved that God is the Sovereign Good, for the universal good stands far above any particular good, even as the good of the nation is greater than the good of an individual, since the goodness and perfection of the whole stand above the goodness and perfection of the part. Now the divine goodness of God is compared to all other things as the universal good to the particular, for He is the good of every good, as we have proved. Therefore He is the Sovereign Good. Moreover, that which is predicated essentially is said more truly than that which is predicated by participation. Now God is good by His essence, and other things, by participation, as shown above. He is the Sovereign Good. Again, the greatest in any genus is the cause of others in that genus, since the cause is greater than its effect. Now all things derive their ratio of goodness from God, as we have shown. Therefore He is the Sovereign Good. Moreover, just as that is more white which has less admixture of black, so that is better which has less admixture of evil. Now God is most of all unmixed with evil, since in Him there can be no evil, neither in act nor in potentiality, and this becomes Him by His very nature, as we have proved. Therefore He is the Sovereign Good. Hence it is said 1 Kings 2:2, "There is none holy as the Lord is." Chapter 42. That God is one. Having proved the foregoing, it is manifest that there is only one God, for it is impossible that there be two sovereign goods, since that which is ascribed to a thing by way of superabundance is to be found in one alone. Now God is the Sovereign Good, as we have shown. God is one. Further, we have shown that God is absolutely perfect, and that He lacks no perfection. If, then, there be several gods, it follows that there are several such like perfect things. But that is impossible, for if none of them lacks any perfection, nor has any admixture of imperfection, which is required for anything to be simply perfect, there will be nothing by which they can be distinguished. Therefore it is impossible that there be several gods. Again, that which is sufficiently done if it be supposed to be done by one, is better done by one than by many. Now the order of things is the best possible, since the potency of the first agent does not fail the potentiality of things for perfection, and all things are sufficiently perfected by referring them to one first principle. Therefore a plurality of principles is inadmissible. Moreover, it is impossible for one continual and regular movement to proceed from several movers, for if they moved together, none of them is a perfect mover, but all together take the place of one perfect mover, which does not apply to the first mover, since the perfect precedes the imperfect. If, however, they move not together, each of them is at one time moving, and at another time not, whence it follows that the movement is neither continuous nor regular, because movement that is continuous and one is from one mover. Moreover, a mover that is not always moving is found to move irregularly, as evidenced by movers of lower degree, wherein violent movement is intense at first and slackens at the end, while natural movement is the reverse. On the other hand, the first movement is one and continuous, as was proved by the philosophers. Therefore its first mover must needs be one. Again, corporeal substance is directed to spiritual substance as its good, for there is in the latter a fuller goodness to which corporeal substance seeks to be likened, since whatever exists desires to attain the greatest good as far as possible. Now all movements of the corporeal creature are found to be reduced to one first movement, beside which there is no other first movement not reducible to it. Therefore beside the spiritual substance, which is the end of the first movement, there is no other that cannot be reduced to it. Now under this name we understand God. Therefore there is only one God. Moreover, the mutual order of all diverse things that are directed to each other is on account of their order towards some one thing, even as the mutual order of the parts of an army is on account of the order of the whole army to the commander-in-chief. For that certain diverse things be united together in some relationship, cannot result from their own natures as distinct from one another, because from this there would rather result distinction among them. Nor can it result from different causes of order, because these could not possibly of themselves, as differing from one another, have one order in view. Accordingly, either the mutual order of many is accidental, or it must be reduced to one first cause of that order, who sets all in order towards the end which he intends. Now, all the parts of this world are observed to be ordered to one another, in so far as certain things are aided by certain others. Thus the lower bodies are moved by the higher, and the latter by incorporeal substances, as shown above. Is this accidental, since it happens always or for the most part? Wherefore this world has but one director and governor. But there is no other world besides this. Therefore there is but one governor of the universe, and him we call God. Again, if there be two things both of which are of necessity, they must needs agree in the intention of the necessity of being. It follows, therefore, that they must be differentiated by something added either to one or to both of them, and consequently that either one is composite, or both. Now no composite thing exists necessarily per se, as we have proved above. Therefore there cannot possibly be several things each of which exists necessarily, and consequently neither can there be several gods. Moreover, that in which they differ, on the supposition that they agree in the necessity of being, is either required as a complement in some way to this necessity of being, or is not required. If not, it follows that it is accidental, because whatever is added to a thing that has nothing to do with its being is an accident. Therefore this accident has a cause, and this cause is either the essence of that which exists of necessity, or something else. If it is its essence, since the very necessity of being is its essence, as shown above, necessity of being will be the cause of that accident. But necessity of being is found in both. Therefore both have that accident, and consequently are not differentiated thereby. If, however, the cause of this accident be something else, it follows that unless this something else exist, this accident would not exist. And without this accident there would not be the aforesaid distinction. Therefore without that something else, these two things that are supposed to exist of necessity would be not two, but one. Therefore the proper being of both is dependent on a third, and consequently neither of them exists necessarily per se. If, on the other hand, that in which they differ be necessary as a complement to their necessity of being, this will be either because it is included in the notion of the necessity of being, as animate is included in the definition of animal, or because necessity of being is specified thereby as animal is completed by rational. In the first case, it follows that wherever there is necessity of being, there is that which is included in its notion. Thus to whatever we can apply animal we can apply animate. And thus, since we ascribe necessity of being to both the aforesaid, they cannot be differentiated thereby. In the second case, this is again impossible, for the difference that specifies a genus does not complete the generic idea, but the genus acquires thereby being in act, because the notion of animal is complete before the addition of rational. Although animal cannot be an act except it be either rational or irrational. Now, this is impossible for two reasons. First, because the quiddity of that which has being of necessity is its being, as we have proved above. Because thus necessary being would acquire being from something else which is impossible. Therefore it is impossible to have several things each of which has necessary being per se. Further, if there be two gods, this word God is predicated of both either univocally or equivocally. If equivocally, this is beside the present question, for nothing prevents anything receiving an equivocal name, if the usual mode of speech allow. If, however, it be predicated univocally, it must be said of both in the same sense, and thus it follows that in both there is the same nature in common. Either, therefore, this nature is in both according to the same being, or else it is according to different beings. If according to one being, it follows that they are not two but only one, for two things have not one being if they differ substantially. If, however, there is a different being in both, the quiddity of neither will be its own being. But we must admit this to be the case in God, as we have proved. Therefore neither of them is what we understand by the name of God, and consequently it is impossible to admit the existence of two gods. Again, none of the things that belong to a particular signate thing as such can possibly belong to another, because the singularity of a particular thing belongs to no other but the singular thing itself. Now, its necessity of being belongs to that which is of necessity in as much as it is this signate thing. Therefore it cannot possibly belong to any other thing, and thus it is impossible that there be several things each of which exists of necessity. Therefore it is impossible that there be several gods. Proof of the middle proposition: if that which is of necessity is not this signate thing as being of necessity, it follows that the designation of its being is not necessary in itself, but depends on something else. Now a thing according as it is in act is distinct from all else, and this is to be this signate thing. Therefore that which is of necessity depends on something else for being in act, and this is contrary to the notion of that which is of necessity. Therefore that which is of necessity must be of necessity according as it is this signate thing. Again, the nature signified by this word God is individualized either by itself in this God or by something else. If by something else, there must be composition therein. If by itself, it follows that it cannot be applied to another, for that which is the principle of individualization cannot be common to several. Therefore it is impossible that there be several gods. Moreover, if there be several gods, it follows that the divine nature is not identically the same in each. Therefore there must be something to distinguish the divine nature is this one and that one. But this is impossible, since the divine nature receives no addition whether of essential or of accidental differences. As proved above, is the divine nature the form of any matter, so as to be divided as the matter is divided? Therefore there cannot possibly be several gods. Again, the being proper to each thing is but one. Now God is himself his very being, as shown above. Therefore there can be but one God. Further, a thing has being according as it has unity, wherefore everything shuns division so far as it can, lest it thus tend to not being. But the divine nature surpasses all in having being. Therefore there is supreme unity therein. Therefore it is nowise divided into several. Moreover, we observe that in every genus multitude proceeds from some kind of unity, wherefore in every genus we find one first thing, which is the measure of all things found in that genus. Hence whatever things we find agreeing in one point must proceed from some one principle. Now all things agree in the point of being. Therefore that which is the principle of all things must needs be one only, and this is God. Again, in every government he who presides desires unity, wherefore the chief form of government is a monarchy or kingdom. And of our many members there is one head, and this is an evident sign that unity is due to whom headship is becoming. Wherefore we must confess that God, who is the cause of all, is simply one. We can moreover infer this confession of the divine unity from the sacred oracles, for it is said Deuteronomy 6:4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one, and thou shalt not have strange gods before me, and one Lord, one faith," etc. By this truth the heathens who believe in many gods are refuted, and yet several of them affirm the existence of one supreme God, by whom they asserted that the others whom they called gods were caused, for they ascribed the Godhead to all eternal substances, especially by reason of wisdom, felicity and governance of the universe. This mode of expression is found even in Holy Writ, where holy angels or men or judges are called gods, as in the words of the Psalm, "There is none among the gods like unto thee, O Lord," and again, "I have said you are gods," and many like passages are found throughout Scripture. Wherefore the Manichaeans would seem yet more opposed to this truth, since they assert two first principles, the one of which is not the cause of the other. The Arians too impugn this truth by their errors, since they asserted that the Father and the Son are not one but distinct gods, and yet were compelled by the authority of Scripture to confess that the Son is true God. Chapter 43. That God is infinite. Now while the infinite is a sequel of quantity, as philosophers teach, infinity cannot be ascribed to God in respect of multitude, seeing that it has been proved that there is but one God, and that there is no composition either of parts or of accidents in him. Nor may we say that he is infinite in respect of continuous quantity, since we have shown that he is incorporeal. It remains therefore to inquire whether infinity is becoming to him in respect of spiritual magnitude. This spiritual magnitude is referable to two things, namely to power, and to the goodness or perfection of a thing's very nature. For a thing is said to be more or less white according to the degree of perfection in its whiteness, and the magnitude of power is gauged from the magnitude of deeds or of things made. Now in these things the magnitude of one follows the magnitude of the other, because from the very fact that a thing is in act it is active, and consequently according to the degree in which it is perfected in its act, is the degree of magnitude in its power. Wherefore spiritual things are said to be great according to their degree of perfection, for Augustine says that in things which are great not by bulk, to be great is to be good. Accordingly we have to show that God is infinite according to this kind of magnitude, not, however, so that infinite be understood privatively, as in dimensive or numeral quantity, for a quantity of this kind is naturally finite, so that we speak of infinity by subtraction of that which it has by nature, and for this reason infinity in those quantities denotes imperfection. But in God the infinite is understood only negatively, because there is no bound or end to his perfection, and he is the supremely perfect being, and it is thus that the infinite should be ascribed to God. For whatever is finite by its nature is confined to some generic notion. Now God is in no genus, and his perfection contains the perfections of all genera, as we have shown above. Therefore he is infinite. Moreover, every act inherent to something else receives its limitation from that in which it is, since that which is in another is in it according to the mode of the recipient. Wherefore an act that exists in no subject has no limitations. For instance, if whiteness were per se existent, the perfection of whiteness therein would not be limited from having whatever it is possible to have of the perfection of whiteness. Now God is an act nowise existing in another, because neither is he form in matter, as we have proved, nor is his being inherent to any form or nature, since he is his own being, as we have shown above. Therefore it follows that he is infinite. Again, in things we find something that is pure potentiality, as primary matter, something that is pure act, namely God, as we have shown above, and something that is act and potentiality, namely other things. Now as potentiality, since it bears relation to an act, cannot exceed that act in any particular thing, so neither can it simply. Therefore, since primary matter is infinite in its potentiality, it follows that God, who is pure act, is infinite in his actuality. Again, an act is the more perfect, according as it is less mingled with potentiality. Wherefore every act that has an admixture of potentiality has a limit to its perfection, while the act which has no admixture of potentiality has no limit to its perfection. Now God is pure act without any potentiality, as we have proved above. He is infinite. Again, being itself, considered absolutely, is infinite, for it can be participated by an infinite number of things in an infinite number of ways. Hence if we take a thing with finite being, this being must be limited by some other thing which is in some way the cause of that being. Now there can be no cause of God's being, since he is necessary of himself. Therefore he has infinite being, and himself is infinite. Moreover, whatever has a particular perfection is the more perfect according as it more fully participates that perfection. Now there cannot be, nor even be imagined, a way in which a perfection is possessed more fully than by that which is perfect by its essence, and whose being is its goodness, and such is God. Therefore in no way can anything be imagined better or more perfect than God. Therefore he is perfect in goodness. Further, our intellect reaches the infinite in understanding, a sign of which is that given any finite quantity, our intellect can imagine a greater. Now it would be to no purpose for the intellect to be thus directed to the infinite unless there were infinite intelligible being. Therefore there must be some infinite intelligible thing, which must needs be the greatest of all beings, and this we call God. Therefore God is infinite. Again, an effect cannot extend beyond its cause. Now our intellect cannot be but from God, who is the first cause of all things. Therefore our intellect cannot think of anything greater than God. If then it is possible to think of something greater than every finite thing, it follows that God is not finite. Moreover, infinite power cannot be in a finite essence because everything acts by its form, which is either its essence or part thereof, and power denotes a principle of action. But God has not a finite active power, for he moves in infinite time, and this cannot be save from an infinite power, as we have shown above. Therefore it follows that God's essence is infinite. This argument, however, avails for those who hold to the eternity of the world, and if this be not supposed, our opinion about the infinity of the divine power is confirmed yet more. For every agent is the more powerful to act according as it reduces to act a potentiality the further removed from act. Thus a greater power is needed to heat water than air. Now that which is not at all, is infinitely distant from act, nor is it in any way in potentiality. Wherefore, if the world was made after previously not being at all, the Maker's power must needs be infinite. This argument, even for those who hold to the eternity of the world, avails to prove the infinity of the divine power. For they confess that God is the cause of the substance of the world, although they aver that it is eternal, since they say that the eternal God is the cause of an eternal world in the same way as a foot would have been from eternity the cause of a footprint, if it had trod on the dust from eternity. Now this opinion being presupposed, it follows nonetheless from the argument stated above, that the power of God is infinite. For whether he fashioned things from time, as we hold, or from eternity, as they maintain, there cannot be in things anything that he has not produced, since he is the universal source of being, and so he produced them without any pre-existing matter or potentiality. Now active power must needs be in proportion to passive potentiality, because the greater the passive potentiality that is pre-existent or presupposed, the greater the active power which completes its actuality. Hence it follows, since a finite power produces an effect if we presuppose the potentiality of matter, that God's power, which presupposes no potentiality, is not finite but infinite, and that consequently his essence is infinite. Moreover, a thing lasts so much the longer as its cause is more efficacious. Consequently, a thing which is of infinite duration must have being through a cause of infinite efficacy. Now God is of infinite duration, for it has been shown above, that he is eternal. Since then he has no cause of his being besides himself, it follows that he is infinite. The authority of Holy Writ bears witness to this truth, for the psalmist says, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and of his greatness there is no end." The same truth is attested by the statements of the oldest philosophers, since all of them, compelled as it were by truth itself, asserted that the first principle of things is infinite. For they knew not what they said, believing the infinity of the first principle to be after the manner of a discrete quantity, as Democritus maintained, asserting an infinite number of atoms to be the principles of things, and as Anaxagoras held, stating that the principles of things are an infinite number of similar parts, or after the manner of continuous quantity, as those who held that some element, or some undefined infinite body, is the first principle of all. But since it was proved by the researches of subsequent philosophers that there is no infinite body, and if to this we add that the first principle must needs be infinite in some way, it follows that the infinite which is the first principle is neither a body nor a power residing in a body. Chapter 44. That God is an intelligent being. It may be shown from the above that God is an intelligent being, for it was proved that it is impossible to proceed to infinity in movers and things moved, and that all things moved must be reduced, as is probable, to one self-moving principle. Now a self-mover moves itself by appetite and apprehension, for such like things alone are found to move themselves, since it is in them to be moved and not to be moved. Wherefore the moving part in the first self-mover must needs be appetitive and apprehensive. Now in that movement which is by appetite and apprehension, the appetite and apprehender is a moved mover, while appetible and apprehended is a mover not moved. Since then that which is the first mover of all, which we call God, is a mover altogether unmoved, It follows that it is compared to the motor, which is a part of the self-mover as the appetible to the aedient, not, however, as the appetible to the sensitive appetite, because the sensitive appetite is not of the good simply, but of this particular good, since also sensitive apprehension is only of the particular, and that which is good and appetible simply, is prior to that which is good and appetible here and now. Therefore the first mover must be the appetible as an object of the understanding, and consequently the mover that desires itself must be an intelligent being. Much more therefore is the very first appetible an intelligent being, because that which desires it becomes actually understanding through being united to it as an intelligible object. Therefore it follows that God is intelligent, if it be supposed that the first mover moves itself, as the early philosophers maintained. Again, the same conclusion follows necessarily, if movable things be reduced not to some first self-mover, but to a mover that is utterly immovable. For the first mover is the universal principle of movement. Wherefore, since every mover moves by some form which it intends in moving, it follows that the form by which the first mover moves must be universal form and universal good. Now a form is not found under conditions of universality save in the intellect. Therefore the first mover, which is God, must be intelligent. Moreover, in no order of movers do we find that a mover by the intellect is the instrument of that which moves without intellect, but rather the opposite. Now all movers that are in the world are compared to the first mover, which is God, as instruments to the principal agent. Since then we find in the world many movers by intellect, it is impossible that the first mover move without intellect. Therefore God must of necessity be intelligent. Again, a thing is intelligent from the fact of its being without matter, in sign of which forms become understood by being abstracted from matter. Hence also understanding is of universals and not of singulars, because matter is the principle of individualization. Now forms actually understood become one with the intellect actually understanding. Wherefore, if forms are actually understood from the very fact that they are without matter, it follows that a thing is actually intelligent from the fact that it is without matter. Now it was shown above that God is absolutely immaterial, therefore he is intelligent. Again, God lacks no perfection that is to be found in any genus of things, as we have proved above, nor does it follow from this that there is any composition in him, as was also shown above. Now the greatest among the perfections of things is that a thing is intellectual, because thereby it is, after a fashion, all things, having in itself the perfection of all. Therefore God is intelligent. Moreover, whatever tends definitely to an end, either prescribes that end to itself, or that end is prescribed to it by another, else it would not tend to this end rather than to that. Now natural things tend to definite ends, for they do not pursue their natural purposes by chance, since in that case those purposes would not be realized always or for the most part, but seldom, for of such is chance. Since then they do not prescribe the end to themselves, for they do not apprehend the notion of end, it follows that the end is prescribed to them by another, who is the author of nature. This is he who gives being to all, and who necessarily exists of himself, whom we call God, as shown above. Now he would be unable to prescribe nature its end unless he were intelligent. Therefore God is intelligent. Moreover, whatever is imperfect originates from something perfect, because the perfect naturally precedes the imperfect, as act precedes potentiality. Now the forms that exist in particular things are imperfect, since their existence is limited and does not extend to the full universality of their nature. Wherefore they must needs originate from certain perfect and not limited forms. Now such forms are impossible except as an object of the understanding, since no form is found in a state of universality except in the intellect. Consequently those forms must be intelligent if they are subsistent, for in no other way can they be operative. Therefore it follows that God, who is the first subsistent act, from which all others derive, is intelligent. The Catholic faith confesses this truth, for it is said of God, he is wise in heart and mighty in strength, and with him is strength and wisdom, and in the psalm, thy knowledge is become wonderful to me, and oh the depth of the riches of the wisdom and of the knowledge of God. The truth of this belief took such hold on men that they named God from understanding, for Theos, which is the Greek for God, is derived from Theistai, which means to consider or to see. Dash.